When Cal Ripken first stepped onto the field of Orioles Park at Camden Yards in 1992, he said, "It feels like baseball has been played here before." That no doubt delighted Janet Marie Smith, one of the designers of the ballpark that has been the model for the so-called retro parks that have been built over the past 20 years. She's currently the Vice President of Planning and Development for the Baltimore Orioles. Ms. Smith, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining me is Greg Sherlock, a principal at Populous, a global architectural firm. He was the lead designer of Cincinnati's Great American Ballpark and the new Miami Marlins Ballpark. Greg, welcome.
Thank you.
And Professor Philip Best, Director of Graduate Studies at the University of Notre Dame School of Architecture, where he teaches urban design and theory. He helped organize and lend credibility to the movement to save Fenway Park. Professor Best, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill. It's nice to be here.
Yesterday, the Red Sox celebrated the 100th anniversary of Fenway Park. Philip Best, tell us a little bit about the days of the late 90s when it looked as if Fenway would be a target for the wrecking ball.
Happily, a group of baseball fans and civic-minded neighborhood residents came to the rescue. They sponsored this proposal to figure out alternative ways to save, to renovate Fenway Park, in opposition to the plan that the then Red Sox owners had put together to demolish Fenway Park and build a replica adjacent to it. And they perceived rightly that that would not have been good for the Red Sox and not have been good for Boston and the neighborhood. And so we organized this design charrette, and happily some good things came out of it.
Ms. Smith, from 2002 until 2009, you worked with the current Red Sox owners to not only save but significantly renovate Fenway Park. How did you go about preserving tradition while providing modern amenities there?
Well, one of the criteria that John Henry, Tom Warner, and Larry Lucchino gave to the design team was that we were going to play ball there. We were not going to move the Red Sox away from Fenway. And in many respects, I think that criteria helped shape the end solutions, because it meant instead of going in and doing a wholesale remodel of Fenway Park, we were looking to do seasonal improvements. So we only had, 4 months each off season to do construction. And that incremental approach, I think, allowed us to get to know the fan base. It allowed us to get to know the ballpark. It allowed our architects, D'Agostino, Izzo, and Quirk, to look closely at how things could be woven into the park instead of hammered into them. And we learned a lot from the work that Phil Bess and his group did. They really did bring one of the first credible plans for renovating Fenway to the table.
Mr. Sherlock, you've not only been the lead designer for three major league ballparks, you have helped develop facilities for a soccer team in Guadalajara and baseball teams in Taipei and Hiroshima. Is there a common approach evident in all those recent projects?
Somewhat. The framework from an architect's mind in terms of designing a building is understanding its location. You know, we really dig down in the beginning to find the essence of the place. And those sort of findings begin to manifest themselves in a lot of different ways, sometimes abstract, sometimes in rational ways, sometimes in poetic ways.
Ms. Smith, do you have the feeling that the ballparks that we're celebrating today, Fenway and others, are a direct result of having sort of botched designs sort of in previous decades?
I might say it a little bit differently. certainly celebrating Fenway is its own thing, right? There's been no baseball park in America that's ever gotten to 100. And Oriole Park at Camden Yards, which just turned 20 this season, certainly pays homage to Fenway and the way that it fits into the city, the saving of the B&O warehouse, and even the seat color, the masonry arches and the steel trusses are borrowed from that era. But the generation of parks, which we love to hate, those multi-purpose facilities, weren't really anybody's fault. So it's kind of nice that we're back to a point of having our own parks so that they can really be a reflection of the game that's going on there.
I'll direct the next question to Philip Best. Do you have a favorite stadium?
I've been going to Wrigley Field for, goodness, 31 years, and I do not get tired of going to Wrigley Field. I would have to say Wrigley is unquestionably tops on my list. I've been back to Fenway now, I think, three times since Janet Marie and her team have been working their magic, and really enjoy it. I've enjoyed the couple of occasions I've been to Camden Yards. Coors Field is one of the better ones, PNC in Pittsburgh. Generally, I prefer the ones that are clearly site-specific and that have views of the city, views of a river, something that locates it specifically in its place.
And Mr. Sherlock, what about you?
My favorite stadium in the world is the Munich Olympic Stadium by Freyato. I experienced this as a sort of a young traveling architect through Europe, and it's really a wonderful stadium. It just blends in with this park setting. The bowl is sort of set into the ground, and it's this glass sort of tent structure that organically sort of drapes over the top. Mm. And it really does elevate your senses of place. So that would be the most profound stadium, in my opinion.
We're in the age of retro ballparks now. The age of the multipurpose park has apparently passed. I hope it has. And nobody's excited about artificial turf these days. But what's the next generation of stadia likely to look like?
The stadium of the future is going to be in a facility that's transformable, if you will. You know, you can imagine a retractable roof, changing seating configurations, all these kinds of things that allow a facility sort of to adapt itself. And this would have to be successful, this would have to go much further beyond what we think of from the old multipurpose stadiums.
Ms. Smith, do you go along with this idea of transformable buildings?
Yeah, I think that that makes a lot of sense. I might put a footnote on the word retro. When HOK set out to design Oriole Park at Camden Yards, there wasn't any notion of making it a retro park. I think the media has picked up on that term just because it's a quick soundbite. But It was really meant, as Bill Best said a moment ago, about fitting into the context and using the surroundings to tell you what to do. And I know their approach on AT&T Park and PNC in Pittsburgh were based on that kind of response. But I would argue that Craig's new park in Miami is a contextual park. You know, it's responding to things about Miami and South Beach and how it sits there. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways of looking at that.
Mr. Bess, are you okay with this idea of transformable buildings as long as they reflect the context of the team?
No, actually, I may have a little bit of a different perspective on this. Well, I agree with Janet that the whole idea of retro ballparks is a kind of media soundbite. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems with it, I think, is that it blurs the distinction between the urban ballparks that were built in the 90s and the urban ballparks that were built prior to 1923. They were really built between 1909 and 1923, the ones of which Wrigley and Fenway are the only survivors, you know, the group that included Ebbets Field and Forbes Field and Yankee Stadium and all that group. And one of the big differences, I think, between that group of ballparks and what's been built in the 90s is that the ones in the 90s are urban, but it's kind of a consumer item under the generic heading of entertainment, whereas the ballparks that were built in the early part of the 20th century were parts of cities that were conceived of as neighborhoods. Springsteen played Fenway a couple years ago. Springsteen's going to play Wrigley this year. Both Fenway and Wrigley, designed first as baseball parks in neighborhoods, nevertheless lend themselves to other kinds of uses. What I think that suggests, a way to go to think about these ballparks, is to, again, think about the ballpark first for baseball and realize that in thinking about it first as baseball, it's going to create a certain character to the park that's going to make it lovable, that in turn makes it a popular venue for other kinds of activities. And I don't see a whole lot of that that's happened even in the last 20 years.
Philip Bess is the author of City Baseball Magic, Plain Talk and Uncommon Sense about Cities and Baseball, among other books. He's also the director of graduate studies at the University of Notre Dame School of Architecture. Professor Bess, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Greg Sherlock's most recent Major League Baseball project is Marlins Ballpark in Miami. He's a principal at Populous, a global sports facility design firm, and he joined me from KCUR in Kansas City. Mr. Sherlock, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Enjoyed the conversation.
And Janet Marie Smith is the Baltimore Orioles Vice President of Planning and Development, but you can find her fingerprints on venues in Atlanta and Boston, as well as at Camden Yards. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. We had help this week from John Steele at KUHF in Houston and from Alex Smith at KCUR in Kansas City. Special thanks to Amanda Art and to Tovia Smith. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's Fenway Park pictures or view the Houston Chronicle's Astrodome photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word this week comes from the machinery used to take down Tiger Stadium on July 15, 2008. There used to be a ballpark right there. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.